has been spent on the Land and Water Conservation Fund. I want to go back, though, to as much for the record as anything else. President Bush said in 2001 that in outlining his budget proposal for that year, quote, "I proposed fully funding the Land and Water Conservation Fund. $900 million will fully fund the fund. It's the highest request in the fund's history, and half the money will go to the states, just like the authors of the law intended." So am I not correct that in the president's first budget, he did ask for full funding of the Land and Water Conservation Fund?
Senator, we believe the president has asked for full funding in each year. The 2002 budget of the president actually did distribute the funds 454 federal and 454 stateside. Working with Congress, we ended up with a different mix and subsequently have moved forward with the alternatives that I've described here this morning.
I gather, and maybe it's easier for me to say than for you, but some members of Congress weren't willing to appropriate $900 million to Land and Water Conservation Fund, so you took a different tack. Is that close to right?
As I noted, in 2002, we provided a very traditional approach, Congress gave us other directions, and subsequently we have worked with that direction to provide a different mix and focus on our cooperative conservation efforts.
Diplomatically stated. But President Bush did say in his campaign, and as you said, he, through his definition, believes he has continued to, but in his first budget, he put 450 and 450 in the traditional way of funding the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And while we'll hear more from Henry Diamond in the next panel, I want to emphasize that my own experience with the Land and Water Conservation Fund came when President Reagan asked me to be chairman of the President's Commission on Americans Outdoors in 1985 and 86. And while we recommended a broad number of proposals that were mainly outside Washington, the one proposal we agreed on was to spend at least $1 billion a year from offshore drilling on the Land and Water Conservation Fund. I only have one question about that. You say that the administration opposes mandatory funding, and so did several other senators. But would you not agree that the program that's been in place since 1920s, which gives 50% of royalties from drilling for oil and gas onshore, isn't that mandatory funding? That money goes directly to the states. The appropriations committees of Congress never get a penny of it. Wouldn't that be considered to be mandatory funding?
Senator, as was noted in several of the testimonies several of the comments by other senators, there certainly are a number of areas where we have mandatory spending, and the 50% share that's automatic might fall into that kind of category.
Does the administration propose taking the $500 million that goes to Wyoming each year and the other onshore oil and gas drilling money that automatically goes to states and putting it in the federal treasury for appropriation each year in order to deal with the budget deficit?
Senator, I think we're certainly not proposing changing any of the current allocations. We look at each proposal as it comes forward, and in this particular instance, of course, Congress has a long history of opining on the appropriate allocation of those monies offshore, dating back, I think, to the 1940s when the Submerged Land Acts actually determined that rather than having those first 3 miles be federal, they would be state, and 100% of those monies would go to states, again, automatically. Subsequently, the change to the law that allowed the next 3 miles to have a 27%+ distribution to the coastal states. So we look forward to continuing to work with Congress on what the appropriate ongoing distribution is.
And isn't it true that there's something called Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson, which are federal laws passed several years ago, through which hunters and fishermen pay license fees that automatically go for wildlife conservation, and wouldn't that also be considered mandatory spending that doesn't go through the appropriations process?
Senator, as noted before, there certainly are many programs that are mandatory. I think our concern is that of adding to those programs, particularly at a time with a lot of other federal priorities. We're increasingly seeing, as we put our budget together, the important ability to flexibly meet needs such as law enforcement, such as maintenance backlog as they surface. So our concern would be adding to the mandatory programs that already exist.
I accept that. And, Mr. Chairman, as a concluding comment, I think it is a matter of priorities, really, and since it was President Reagan's commission that recommended this, and President George H.W. Bush endorsed that commission, and since this President Bush has said he wants to fully fund the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and since we already create a state royalty for onshore oil and gas drilling, it seems to me a little different and appropriate, even in light of budgetary considerations, to say let's take 25 or 30% of offshore oil drilling and devote that to a state royalty for conservation purposes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Senator Murkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a very quick question. The Coastal Impact Assistance Program Alaska received in 2001, It was a little over $12 million in coastal impact assistance, and I'm trying to understand, under the proposal that we have before us by Senator Alexander and Landrieu, what would the coastal impact assistance be to Alaska on an annual basis?
I'm afraid I'll have to get back to you with that specific amount because there's a formula and it's somewhat complicated, but we would be happy to go through the numbers and figure out what that might be.
But it is complicated. You know, you want to know whether you're going to be better under the new proposal than you are under the status quo, and quite honestly, I can't determine that, so I would like an answer from that if we could get that from you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Would you get that answer as soon as you can?
Yes, we will. Thank you.
Senator Craig.
Lynn, thank you very much. I'll ask unanimous consent that my statement be a part of the record.
It'll be made a part of the record.
Lynn, maintenance backlogs on all of our public lands, BLM, Forest Service, parks, continues to grow and is estimated now to be over $23 billion. And some of those backlogs are considered to be life-threatening or hazardous to humans who might traffic those areas. Although we don't know how much federal land this bill would add to the federal estate, the sponsors have indicated that they plan on a federal land acquisition provision to be added. If, like in past proposals, we add 100 or 450 to 500 million of direct federal land acquisition spending over the next 6 years in the bill, or 20 years in the House version, we're talking about $2.7 to $10 billion over the potential life of this legislation.
Thank you, dear.
At the same time, in three of the last 4 years, we have expended more than $1 billion on firefighting, and this year, with what's going on in the West and in Alaska, we have the chance of a record burn year and a record cost year. The good news is, I guess, that in Nevada, the fire is under control. A variety of homes and small businesses, but no lives lost. Lynn, do you really believe that we can continue to acquire federal land when we don't have the funding needed to maintain the land we've got?
Senator, thank you for raising the matter of the maintenance backlog. Secretary Norton's number one priority is to invest in maintaining the lands that we have, and President Bush, of course, committed to addressing the $4.9 billion estimated backlog on the national park lands, and that is what we are focused on doing. It is for this reason that we have focused our conservation efforts on partnerships, that is, rather than land acquisition, working in partnership with private landowners to achieve conservation goals, rather than putting additional land into the federal dominion.
The conservation partnership approach is such a positive one because in that relationship, a great deal is learned and a cooperative environment is created. Out west, if it's fed land, oftentimes the sign goes up, the gate goes closed, and don't tread, all in the name of the environment. That can be tremendously frustrating at times in a state like mine that is 63% owned by the federal government, and you're one of our larger landlords, and sometimes we don't like you very much in the style of your stewardship. Do you think it is responsible for the government to suggest that any additional federal land acquisition be reasonable and prudent in context with its ability to maintain it?
Senator, first, I hope that our stewardship has created
improved
relations.
It's improving.
We have certainly focused on trying to do that. Again, our priority is to focus on caring for the lands that we have. We do have an opportunity at the request of the House Appropriations Committee to create a land transaction strategy or plan that we are to submit in December. And we expect that that plan will help to set priorities and give some greater focus to how we undertake our land transactions and where we focus dollars, and I look forward to sharing that with you.
In the development of that strategy, let me ask then one other thing. I would like you to provide to this committee a list of the federal land acquisitions that have been made over the last 10 years. I think as we talk about acquiring more land, it is important we know what we're doing now. I've not seen the grand total of 10 years' worth of federal acquisition, but I think it would be quite surprising in the total volume and number of acres acquired, and so I think it would be important to do that. And in doing so, how much of its cost is in acquisition? How about new maintenance costs? Of course, we know the fire suppression and suppression costs right now. We're stealing from all kinds of accounts within the system to fight fires. And then we don't replenish the money back into the accounts. And so the stewardship programs, the conservation programs, fire suppression programs, or pre-fire programs aren't going funded. And it really, what we're doing out there right now, my guess is if it were fully exposed to the public, would be a phenomenal argument about mismanagement in the first order. And that isn't just on your watch. That's been happening for some time because you have to do what you do at the time fires are underway. And then we here in Congress don't have the money to replenish the funds. So then you can't contract out to do the kind of work that Congress by law and you by definition of good stewardship are allowed to do. And the cycle goes on, and here we want to acquire more land. I mean, that to me is a phenomenal frustration. You know, I'm, as the chairman and others know, I'm a bit obsessed at times on invasive weeds. Small item. You're losing 10,000 to 15,000 acres a year, wipe out just BLM alone, not counting the Forest Service. And you don't have the money to fight them. You won't fight them. You can't fight them. We're trying to change things so that you will fight them. These are weeds that are so obnoxious that even wildlife no longer habitats the area. Erosion sets in because they become the dominant species on the land. Under any reasonable conservation-minded person's attitude, it would suggest that that is phenomenal mismanagement. And yet it goes on today, and it continues to go on. And under greater acquisition, it will go on that land also. That's one example. Last idea here. Somewhere in my memory, I recall that the original land and water conservation law indicated that only 15% of land and water conservation funds would be expended in western states. Has that been the case over the last 20 years? Do we know that we've held at that 15% level?
Senator, I don't know. We'd have to go back and evaluate that.
Hit the total button, if you would, and give us a number. That would be valuable. And would you provide the committee a state-by-state and a year-by-year accounting of the funds expended under the Land and Water Conservation Funds? That ought to be a reasonably easy task to do. I think as we ask, and I know what the senator from Louisiana is about, and I would suggest to her that when money comes off from offshore drilling, the states that are willing to allow that to happen ought to be the recipients of some of those benefits. I'm quite amused by states who come and ask me to join in on land and water conservation funding to acquire lands in their state, but they have a prohibition to offshore drilling. They want to take somebody else's money to benefit their state, but they won't allow the money to be generated offshore of their states. And that example is replete up and down the East Coast and the West Coast. Take somebody else's money so that we can stay pristine. Well, thank you, Louisiana, for supplying a huge supply of oil so all you folks could get here today in your automobiles. Those are some of my frustrations about how we handle these resources. I'm not quite sure I can get to the idea of an entitlement or dedicated funds, especially when we're not funding properly good stewardship and management today at the level that almost any reasonable person would suggest ought to be. Thank you.
Madam Secretary, let me first say to you, I was pleasantly surprised with your grasp of the issues, and I commend you for them. I didn't know you very well, and I had no dealings with you, but I think on this complicated issue, you've done a very good job. I have some questions of you that have to do with the partnership activities, but I'm going to submit them so you can answer them. But I do have something I'd like to lay before you and put in the record. Public law 106-248 was adopted in 3 years ago, and it provided for two things. First, to acknowledge that in the United States there were millions and millions of dollars of in-holding lands, lands which were completely surrounded by the federal government, of no use to anyone but the government. The government had indicated an interest in condemning them, and there were millions that were condemned, neither of which had been paid for. So we said in this legislation, we have surplus federal land. Now, this is not land that anybody should get excited about in the conservation community, and I don't think they did, because this land is not good for anything. It's on the maps already as surplus. We suggested that that ought to be sold in an orderly manner and the proceeds be used to pay these Americans who had not been paid. I would like to know from your department whether that law has been used, either of the two, and if so, how, and if not, why not? Would you do that for us?
Yes, Senator, I believe you're referring to what we sometimes call the BACA legislation.
That's correct.
We have utilized the BACA legislation, but we have not utilized it to the extent originally anticipated. If my memory serves me correctly, and we'll have to get back to you on the right number, I think we may have only done something like $4 million worth of transactions in recent years through the BACA legislation. We are actually very interested, and Secretary Norton has made it a priority to explore working with Congress on some changes to that, which would give a stronger incentive and ability of our agencies to utilize that legislation so that we can achieve the goals set forth. One of the elements of it was a restriction on addressing lands that were in existing resource management plans up to a certain date. And because we've now revised those plans, it puts some of those areas off limits, and we'd like to explore working with you on that.
Well, ma'am, let me tell you one thing I really had learned in my years around here is to make sure that the executive branch does what it's told. We're all arguing about new things, but there's many things that the executive branch doesn't do that are already on the books. This was an important part of acquiring that huge property called the BACA location. I don't think the Republicans would have bought that had we not had this provision in the law. And so I ask you to give us the information, but I want to tell you that I expect, and I'll be here a while, I expect to see you do this. This is not so difficult. It's just that you don't want to devote the time and energy to do it, and the field people don't want to either. Now, having said that, I want to say to my friend, the senator from Louisiana, when I went to your state and we talked about and you showed me how the coastlands were eroding, and you're suggesting this new source of funding. I guess I should have known, but I didn't, that the state of Louisiana was getting a lot of money from the offshore drilling. I thought you were really getting nothing, as you explained what the inland states got from either royalties there or distribution of some of your resources. But I have found that your state have got $969,267,130 from the years 1986 to 2003, which I think is 17 years. Now, what is that money used for? And I don't have to ask you, I can ask Mr.
Angel.
But I do want that on the record, because we're talking here as if you get nothing, while as a matter of fact, you get a lot. But what, do you use it for any of these conservation issues that we're talking about?
Can I answer that, Mr. Chairman? And then
you sure can.
I think you're referring to the amount of money that we get between 3 and 6 miles, which is referred to as the AG track.
That's correct.
It was an agreement that was reached in prior Congresses. It sounds like a lot of money. $900 million is not small change, but relative to what we've produced in that time, it works out to be just a few percentage points, because from those years, if you go back to 1986 in terms of offshore oil and gas production, and I can give you these numbers, the staff can figure them out now. Mr. Chairman, it sounds like a lot of money, but relatively it's minor. It would be less than just a few percentage points. So the case remains the same, that Louisiana produces billions of dollars every year for the federal treasury, and even with the 8G settlement, still only gets a very few percentage points. That money, though, is used for an education trust fund, which was basically established under the direction of Senator Johnson with the help of Senator Breaux before I got here, which has been used very wisely by our state, Mr. Chairman, to help support our universities to promote early childhood education. And unlike Western states that have great flexibility in how that money is used, that money in our state is dedicated to education, as is a lot of the Texas offshore oil and gas money or onshore oil and gas money they put in a trust fund for education as well.
But that was your choice.
Yes, it was. And let me tell you, we're happy for the cheap money, because if it wasn't for AG, we wouldn't get anything. But still, even counting that, it's a fairly small percentage, extremely small percentage of what we produce.
Okay. Any other questions of Secretary? Thank you very much. We're sorry it took so long. You're excused. Oh, Senator Cantwell, did you have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any. I'll ask them in the next panel.
I'm sorry I missed you.
That's all right, Mr. Chairman.
You got here a little late and I missed you.
Yes, I just arrived, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And
you're excused. Next panel, Scott, can you tell me how to say Scott's last name again?
Angel.
Secretary of Louisiana's Department of Natural Resources. John Bauman, Executive Vice President of the International Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, and Nancy Marzulla. These all go together. Okay, we're going to do all six of you if you get there, please. Charles Jordan, Chairman of the Conservation Fund, Portland, Oregon. Henry Diamond, Americans for Our Heritage and Recreation. And Daniel Clifton, Federal Affairs Manager for American for Tax Reform. I think we have your cards there. Daniel Clifton, you start on this side, please. Mary, you're next. No, that's all right. I can see you. Henry Diamond, John, you ready? Okay, can we call you in the order that I announced you, if you don't mind? So the first witness will be Scott Angel. There you are on the right side. Go ahead. Now, would you all put your statements in the record? I'm just now ordering that they be made a part of the record as if you read them, and if you can make them shorter than reading them, we would greatly appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I bring greetings to you from the great state of Louisiana and Governor Kathleen Blanco. My name is Scott Angel. I'm the Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Natural Resources. And while you may wonder where some of the people that will speak today are from, my accent will give you no doubt as to where I come from. I thank you for the opportunity to speak in enthusiastic support of the Americans Outdoors Act. I appreciate so much the comments of the senators today recognizing Louisiana's vital role in providing the energy that this nation needs. I want to especially thank Senator Landrieu for her assistance and her untiring efforts in trying to pass this type of legislation that is so crucial to Louisiana. We believe this act is a sound concept to take non-renewable one-time resources in the form of OCS revenues and to invest them in our renewable resources. The coastal states that host our nation's offshore oil and gas production play a critical role in this country's economic and energy security. Louisiana, like other producing states, is proud to contribute to the fueling of this great nation. And that is precisely why we are here today, to put us in a position to allow us to continue the oil and gas production that this nation needs. But there are costs that come with the national benefits that we provide, cost our environment, and cost to maintain onshore infrastructure that supports offshore energy activities. Sharing OCS revenues with the producing states will provide the steady stream of revenue needed to plan and mitigate the effects of this production. Offshore oil and gas production in the Gulf of Mexico has provided close to $140 billion to the federal government, as Senator Landrieu has said. Up to 90% of that figure has come from Louisiana. This is the second largest source of revenue to the federal government, the first being taxes. In 2002, more than $7.5 billion in offshore revenues went into the federal treasury. More than $5 billion, or two-thirds of that amount, came from offshore Louisiana. Yet, due to the fact that this production was outside the three-mile jurisdiction, we received less than 1% of that. The same year, other states together received more money, or 50% of the revenues generated from mineral production on federal lands within those states. We believe because the nation benefits from drilling on federal lands and because non-coastal states like Wyoming and New Mexico incur impacts from that production, we fully support the share of revenues they receive. However, Louisiana and other producing states are feeling the full impact of offshore oil and gas activity and are not sharing in the revenues. I respectfully point out the inequity because it is profound. Distinguished committee members, Louisiana is losing its coast at a staggering rate of 25 square miles a year, a football field every 30 minutes. We've lost more than 1,900 square miles in the last 70 years, an area the size of the state of Delaware. And the U.S. Geological Survey predicts we'll lose another 1,000 if action is not taken now. Natural processes like subsidence and storms combined with the unintended consequences of federal actions like the levying of the Mississippi River and impacts from offshore oil and gas exploration and development have led to an ecosystem on the verge of collapse. Louisiana truly is America's wetland. It is not a beach, but a vast landscape of wetlands, the seventh largest delta on Earth, where the Mississippi River drains much of the United States. It is one of the most productive ecosystems in America, producing more seafood than any other state in the lower 48. It is the nursery ground for the Gulf of Mexico and habitat for one of the greatest flyways in the world for waterfowl and migratory songbirds. These wetlands protect the largest port system in the world by tonnage. They protect 2 million people and a unique culture from storm surge. They protect America's strategic oil reserves. They protect oil and gas infrastructure that was designed and built with the expectation of this protection. While difficult to imagine, almost 30% of the oil and gas that is consumed in this country comes through the wetlands of Louisiana to be distributed to the rest of the nation. These are truly working wetlands. Through the BRO Act of 1990, we have initiated or completed more than 100 coastal restoration projects and gained great technical and scientific knowledge. We've also cemented long-term partnerships with our five federal agency partners. Last year, the citizens of Louisiana passed three constitutional amendments to address the state's cost share capabilities and to limit liability to the state due to coastal restoration activities. We've worked hard with the United States Army Corps of Engineers producing a comprehensive long-term plan. We will continue to struggle to restore America's wetland, but the cost to restore is in the billions, and Louisiana nor any other state in this union can do it alone. The revenues generated by offshore oil and gas production should be shared to help mitigate the impacts. The nation benefits from this production, and the nation will surely lose if it is not restored. On behalf of my state of Louisiana and other coastal producing states, I urge Congress to enact the America's Outdoors Act. It would show foresight, vision, and would be a gift to our nation for generations to come and put Louisiana in a position to continue to aggressively provide the oil and gas this country so desperately needs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And before we go to the next witness, let me say to you and to those residents of your state and the public officials that this senator is fully aware of what you do for our nation. I tell you, if some of our other states who are coastal states just knew what's happening to America's future because we won't maximize our oil production, if they just knew it and could see it, it probably would be impossible for them to maintain their current posture. But let me tell you how difficult it is. We had an item in a bill, you might remember, Larry, that merely said, let's inventory the value, the resources that are on our coastal states that are not being explored. Let's just find out how much might be there. That was stripped from the bill by a vote because there are states who are even frightened that we would know how much is there. But your state is bearing the burden and producing huge quantities. And frankly, I'd like to do everything I can to help you. I'm not sure that this year is the right time or this bill is the right one, but you know that you have a senator that truly believes that we owe you a lot. And I'll get back in a minute to asking you a question about what you do with what you get, the money you get now.
Thank you.
Let's proceed to John Bauman. Would you please give us your statement and abbreviate it, please?
Huh?
Oh, I'm supposed to take Charles Jordan, excuse me.
If I was standing, you wouldn't have missed me. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
My brain told me what I should do.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. And also to Senator Landrieu and Senator Alexander for this opportunity. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for my opening remarks. I really appreciate you not requiring me to read this document because you have more copies than I do. What I'd like to do is just, you talked about the threat to America, America's future. That is what I want to talk about. Today, I'm not representing the Conservation Fund. I'm speaking for stateside land and water and local areas. And when you talk about America's future, you've got to look at state and local parks. And in Lamar, in 1985-87, as we along with 14 others traveled all around this country for 18 months, talking to Americans about the great outdoors. Thousands of them came and they shared with us their dreams and their hopes for the future. And we were so excited because we thought we were going to make a difference. We completed this report and this is chapter 2. It says, our greatest recreation needs are in urban areas close to home. How quickly we forget. And I will tell you, I've come 3,000 miles to share these moments. I'm not going to be able to finish, so cut me off when you please. But talking about at threat, our young kids, 80 to 85% of all Americans live in and around cities. Now, who is serving those people? We are. They're not going to national parks. They are not going to national parks. They are the ones who are going to inherit these national parks. All of these national treasures you and I talked about setting aside and we're arguing about today, who's going to assume responsibility for those? The people that I am serving today in urban parks, and they don't know anything about this responsibility you're going to drop on them. They are not factoring those costs into their future. They want to buy a home, they want a car, they want to travel. But when they realize the responsibility they have, they are not prepared. So you cannot forget urban parks and state parks. That's where the people are. I sat there, and as I listened to to talk about the national parks, and I used to hear the president talk about national treasures, and I would just wait for him to say something like, well, all of our national treasures are not at national level. We have urban treasures. We have state treasures. No one ever talks about our state and our local treasures. We have parks there that carries quite a story that we like to share with our young people. I just became a grandfather, and I'll tell you, it changed my life because now at the age of 66, I wanted to rest. I wanted to retire and give up, but I can't. Mia, when Mia came into this world, I looked at that little girl and I said, boy, in order to give her a fighting chance, I've got to get back in the race. I've got to try to do all I can to make this a better place. I take her to the park often, local parks. She's too young to go to national parks. But I'm counting on that because the national treasures are just as important to me as the urban treasures. It's not going to be enough for me to take her where she can have fun and games and play. It's coming a time when I need to take Mia to some of our national treasures, to the Underground Railroad. I need to tell her what went on in this place. I need her to feel proud of Harriet Tubman. But also I need Mia to know that she and her white friends are going to do a lot better than you and I have done. And I want her to bring her white friend along when I take her to these places. So as we tell the stories, Harriet Tubman could not have succeeded without white friends. You and I both know that. So we do have a history in succeeding by working together. But all we talk about are the negatives, the slavery and discrimination. When are we going to talk about the positives? We have a history of doing things together. I want Mia to know about those. Yes, I want her to know about slavery and everything else. But I need to take her to those special places. We need the place. The books are not enough. I want to take her to the grounds, and I want to show her what happened here and why it's important that you never forget this, Mia. I want her to know about the responsibility that we have and that we want to make sure that our national parks and our state parks and our urban parks work together, which they don't now. We talk it, we got a lot of verbiage, but we really do not collaborate. That is why we all need lots of money. Sister Landrieu is right. In the last 3 to 4 years, we haven't had any UPAR money. And therefore, the city would not invest in those capital projects because they know they could not complete them. I heard a lot of talk about partnerships. Partnership, that's what we want. We're not asking you to pay for everything, but these are challenging times for us in urban areas. And I won't get so excited, I'll calm down. Yeah. But we need partnerships. And I know it appears as if you are supporting the stateside land and water, but let me tell you, it is needed, but I also want to protect those 17 sites in the national park system that are of significance to African American. And I don't need to tell you, look around this room. Look around this room. There are 73 million blacks and browns in America. Now, can we win this one without them? Can we win the conservation war without them? No. 73 million people are not involved in the great outdoor movement. Look at it. We're facing some challenges. And where are these people now? In and around cities. And who's serving them? We are in our urban parks, and we are having to close down parks. Now, that is not a good testimony. These kids, that's where Mia goes. That's where she meets people of different colors and different backgrounds, and they learn to play together. They learn to win together. And if they learn to play and win together, they're going to continue that through their life, through their adult life. You know, every kid can't dunk a basketball or hit a home run or kick a football, but every kid has a need to at least one time in his or her life to run home that day and say, Mom, today I was number one. That's what we do in urban parks. We help kids win. We give them a taste of victory. We help them to learn to work together. King, you can't do that in national parks. We need an effective national system of parks. We have a national park system, but we don't have a system of parks. There are certain things that are not appropriate for national treasures. But maybe we can say, for this reason, we prefer that you not use that machine in this park simply because it destroys this. However, our state park or our urban parks allow you to do that. If we work together, we could collaborate a lot more. We don't have that. And so on today, when you read my report, you already know everything that's in there. You've heard it many times before. But, Mr. Chairman, I just would hope that you would give some very strong consideration to the challenge that we face at the state and local level. I hate competing with police, fire, homeless, houses. I cannot compete. Parks and recreation are considered to be fun and games. We are not considered basic service. And yet there's no greater partner in an urban area than parks and recreation. And I will close with this. Tonight, at this very moment, there are thousands of kids running up and down community gyms, soccer fields, baseball fields, thousands, different colors, different backgrounds. They are not harming themselves, nor are they harming other people. Where are they going to go? You think they're going to, when we close, are they going to go to the library and sit down and study? We know better. So, today I'm asking that you would give us some assistance. And maybe with a little help, we can keep our promise. Not to Mia and her generation, but to the Roosevelts and the Pinchot and all of the others. Because we made a commitment, and we hope that maybe just with a little help, we can ensure that our legacy will be no less than our inheritance. Thank you.
Amen.
Thank you very much.
Amen.
If we weren't in the Senate hearing, we'd applaud you.
I thank you for hearing me.
And I have 11 Mias.
Oh.
So I have a bigger job than you, right?
That means you're wealthier than I am right now.
Okay, we're going to John Bowman.
Boffman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for trying to put me on before Mr. Jordan. That would have been a lot easier. My name's John Boffman. I'm the Executive Vice President of the International Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. Our association was founded in 1902, and we're the organization of all the public agencies charged with the protection and management of North America's fish and wildlife resources. Our governmental members include fish and wildlife agencies of all 50 states, plus the provinces and territories and federal governments of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The association sincerely appreciates the opportunity to appear before you today to share with you the collective and continued strong support of the 50 state fish and wildlife agencies for the assured wildlife conservation and outdoor recreation funding reflected in S 2590, the Americans Outdoor Act. I'd like to start by thanking you, Senator Menachie, and Senators Alexander and Landreau for again elevating and re-engaging this discussion on what we think is a very important merits of the conservation outdoor recreation funding in this country. At your request, Mr. Chairman, I will be brief. I'll summarize my written testimony, and I think I can do that in 3 points.
I'm going to be in a minute.
First, natural resource conservation, outdoor recreation are important issues to America, typically ranking right up there with national security, the economy, and social programs. I wish I could say that as well as my colleague here did. As our population approaches 300 million in this country, wildlife conservation just doesn't happen. Like clean air and clean water, it takes a reliable and ongoing commitment of human and financial resources. Second, unless Congress makes a multi-year commitment, history shows that we will continue to postpone conservation efforts, which then cost more and result in substantial impacts on public and private lands and on our local communities. We need only to look at the 1,200 species right now on the threatened and endangered species list to witness the financial, administrative, and regulatory burdens that accompany underfunded conservation. And finally, history also clearly demonstrates the tremendous success of fish and wildlife conservation in this country when dedicated and assured funding is available. At the turn of the century, we could look at white-tailed deer, wild turkeys, elk, pronghorn antelope, most of the waterfowl in this country, many species of migratory fish. They were all depleted, some of them near extinction. With the assured and dedicated funding from the state hunting and fishing licenses plus federal excise taxes on sporting arms and ammunition that came along in 1937 with the Pittman-Robertson Act, the excise taxes on fishing equipment that came along in 1950 with the Dingell-Johnson Act, that was supplemented by motorboat fuel and small engine federal side tax in 1984 with the Wallet-Breaux Amendments, The states have been able to join with our federal, nonprofit, and corporate partners, along with the private landowners of this country, to restore all these species I mentioned and their habitats, and likewise the 20 or so species that we have already removed or should be removed, could be removed, from the threatened and endangered species list are those species where adequate funding has been devoted. And you can look at the examples of peregrine falcons, bald eagles, grizzly bears, species where we put the money, we've made the progress. Now it's time to provide conservation for all of America's wildlife, not only those species of fish and wildlife considered game, or those already listed as threatened and endangered, but also the two-thirds of the nation's wildlife, which presently receive too little attention, and many of which could be tomorrow's next threatened and endangered crises. America's wildlife agencies have the expertise, they have the will, and with assured funding, they would have the resources to work with our federal and private partners, including the nation's landowners, to continue our successes, which have made America's system of fish and wildlife conservation the model which other countries seek to emulate. In closing, Mr. Chairman, the International Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies stands ready to assist you and the committee, whatever way we can, to help make America's Outdoors Act a reality for all our citizens. I thank you, and we would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I'm very sorry on your name.
I should spell it differently.
That's right. Henry Diamond.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for having us. I represent the Americans for Our Heritage and Recreation, which is a very broad coalition of folks from ranging from urban people to wilderness advocates. We, of course, thank the committee for having us, and we thank, of course, Lamar Alexander and Senator Landrieu. Our basic thrust is we applaud the introduction of this bill, but urge that federal funding be added to it to fund our national parks and forests and wildlife areas. The Land and Water Fund really has a wonderful long history. In 1958, Congress created the Outdoor Recreation Resources Commission. It made recommendations to the President of Congress, and the centerpiece was the Land and Water Fund. The chairman of the Outdoor Recreation Commission was one of America's great conservationists, Lawrence S. Rockefeller. We lost Lawrence last week. He always cited the creation of the fund as one of his proudest achievements, and indeed, it is a monument to his leadership. In respect, by the way, your colleague, Senator Kyle's father, was a member of that commission, so there is a long-term connection. In response to the recommendations of the commission and to the growing need, Congress created the Land and Water Conservation Fund. As has been noted, but it cannot be stressed too much, a basic principle of fund is that when one public natural resource is sold, at least some of the proceeds should be used to buy another public resource. Thus, Congress dedicated a portion of the receipts of OCS to buy more public land. The fund has been a success. It has brought about conservation and protection of more than 5 million acres of land and water across the country. It has created and consolidated or improved more than 700 different federal land areas. The state side of the program has funded more than 40,000 projects in 98% of the counties in America. My testimony focuses on the federal side, but AHR strongly endorses the state side as well. The Land and Water Fund has provided a lot for the American people, but its future is uncertain. The need for a permanent, adequate fund is urgent. Many decisions will be made over the next 6 years that cannot be put on hold for lack of money. Already we see the losses, and already we pay the consequences in threatened water quality, loss of wildlife habitat, lack of neighborhood parks, and indeed, quality of life. The fund must have a guaranteed revenue stream so that city, state, and federal managers can keep up and plan ahead. A dependable funding source also provides for a timely process in dealing with private landowners, many of whom are waiting for this. The inconsistent record
in providing the promised $900 million of the fund during the past decade dramatically dedicates while this legislation is now essential. We realize that there are very real questions about the budget impacts and the increased federal land holdings this bill might entail. We look forward to discussing this issue and, because of the importance, working with you to resolve them. The federal part of the Land and Water Fund is a key force in conserving our precious places and providing recreation opportunities for the American people. Thus, we urge the committee to amend 2590 to include $450 million for the federal side of the fund and report the bill favorably. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Senator Domenici has stepped out for a moment. He'll be back. Ms. Marzullo.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. I'm testifying on behalf of Defenders of Property Rights, as well as the Keep Private Lands in Private Hands Coalition, a coalition comprised of over 600 state and local organizations dedicated to the principle of private property ownership. Let me say at the outset that we fully support the many important objectives and goals that we've heard discussed this morning, outdoor recreation, conservation, wildlife protection, and the like. However, I am here to testify in opposition to S-2590 to the extent that it provides funding for state acquisition of private property. Likewise, to the extent that the bill may be amended to provide federal funding for federal land acquisition, we also oppose any such amendment. I have only one point to make, and that is that we do not need more government land ownership in this country. Whenever government acquires more land, it acquires more power. Now, this power is not an abstract concept. The architect of communism, Karl Marx, wrote about the relationship between land ownership and power in his Communist Manifesto, stating that you reproach us with planning to do away with your property. Precisely. That is just what we propose. The theory of the communists may be summed up in a single sentence, abolition of private property. Today, most of the world has abandoned communism as a failed idea by reaching out toward protecting private property rights. Countries such as Russia, China, and Cuba are moving toward capitalism and embracing property rights protection. Yet, ironically, this bill and the proposed amendment moves this country back in the direction of communism to the extent that it authorizes abolition of private property. I would further add that my rough calculation, referencing the map that we looked at today, showing government ownership of land in this country, government in the form of the federal government, state government, and local government already owns almost 40% of the land in this country. And that's fee simple ownership. I don't have any figures on how much land government also owns in lesser than fee simple ownership, if you look at leases and easements and the like. And the important thing to note about government ownership of land is that the government not only exercises power over the land it owns title to, but it also exercises power over adjacent land. The federal government relies on Article 4 of the Constitution, or the Property Clause, for its authority to regulate adjacent property. States and local government rely on their police power and other provisions in their state constitutions. Thus, whenever the government is your neighbor, it can reach beyond its borders and control your property in a way that no private neighbor could. Kathy Stupak Thrall and her fellow riparian landowners found this out in Michigan. They had private rights in a lake, and the Forest Service purchased land adjacent to the lake as well, and the forest came in and extinguished state-established, state-created riparian rights in the lake to the point where these landowners were told they could engage in no motorized use of motorized equipment in the on the waters of the lake, including such things as radios. So marina owners were put out of business, and outdoor recreational activities were seriously curtailed. Last but not least, the federal government, using its commerce power, and the state, again, using its police power, today regulates every conceivable aspect of private property ownership through environmental laws and state and local land use laws. In King County, Washington, for example, one proposal would allow landowners to build on only 10% of their land. Landowners would be required to set aside 65% of their land and maintain it in its pristine natural vegetative condition, unable to make any changes to their land whatsoever, thus leaving the property owner with only a small fraction of his, quote, privately owned land with which to put to beneficial and productive use. Thus, we flatly oppose the creation of a massive slush fund for acquisition of additional government-owned land. We obviously recognize that there are instances where the public good will necessitate the acquisition of specific parcels of private property, but we think those instances should be targeted and the power narrowly tailored and exercised. And in closing, I'd like to say that I heard the concept discussed today by Senator Burns and others, the notion of no net loss of private property. We heartily endorse that notion and think that would be a very good way of striking a balance and preserving the balance, in fact, that our founding fathers adopted in our Constitution. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Clifton.
Chairman DiMenti, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Daniel Clifton. I'm the Federal Affairs Manager and Chief Economist at the Americans for Tax Reform. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan coalition that works for lower taxes, fewer regulations, and free markets. Americans for Tax Reform strongly opposes S2590. As we heard in the prior testimony, this is an assault on private property rights. We would also argue that this is an assault on the taxpayer. And I'll give you five major reasons. The first is Chairman Nichols accentuated, we are moving from a discretionary spending program to an entitlement spending. In his example, he used from 1990 to 2004. But if we go back, mandatory was one quarter of the budget. Now it's over 50%, and in the future it will be as high as 75%. We have a real growing need with the mandatory programs to be reforming these programs, not adding on to these programs. The second issue is moving funds that would come out of the Treasury and into a dedicated fund. I know that the sponsors of the bill have worked hard to avoid this. But money is still fungible, and the shift to a dedicated fund will ultimately require higher taxes or more bonding to pay for it. The third is that this would continue the spending spree that Congress has started, which has exacerbated the budget deficit to $400 billion. I know a lot of people like to make a point that this is because of the tax cuts, but the fact is that federal spending is increasing on average almost $100 billion a year. No matter how much tax revenue you're going to have, you're going to have a deficit. Tax revenues don't grow by that much. And the fact here is that this continues that culture of spending in the future. At the same time, many people often tell me that this is so small relative to the budget, the amount of money spending. I would say hardly. We hear this on every program. And when these programs are compounded on top of each other, that's what's leading to these spending increases. In addition, as we heard today, there is a push now to add the federal component onto this legislation. Once we get that in, they'll come back for even more spending and more. And that we have a very big concern with this, watching this process go on since 1999. Another major sticking point is that this would lose flexibility. I know that was discussed. If there's an emergency, revenues would not be able to be offset and moved into the general fund quickly. The accountability gets lost because this money is now in the bureaucratic shuffle. On top of that, the federal and state and local governments own too much land as it is. And these proposals would hurt rural communities and the local property tax base. I know some people say that this is needed to lower local property taxes, but the fact is, by taking more land and stifling economic development has a harsh impact on local communities and their tax bases, which are paying for cops and general services. Again, I would like to say that the federal government revenue situation is improving. Revenues are up. Economic growth is at its fastest rate in 20 years. Now Congress needs to hold the line on spending. This would violate that, exacerbate the budget deficit, and I would urge members to oppose this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Cantwell, we're going to let you ask first since you have not had an opportunity. Are you ready?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that. I appreciate that opportunity and to join my colleagues on this important hearing. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding this hearing. I think this is a very important issue to people in the West, and I would say to people throughout America. Certainly my colleague has a unique circumstance in Louisiana that makes this issue imperative to them, but I can guarantee her that there are other issues throughout the West where there are rapid growing communities who are faced with this challenge of preserving and protecting recreational areas and urban areas. And I think that our challenge has been that we've been basically outpaced by the demand, and consequently this fluctuation in funding through the committee process where funds are actually supposed to be dedicated to these resources and then not actually authorized and appropriated that way has been very frustrating, I think, to lots of local governments throughout America. My question, Mr. Diamond, you seem to have quite a bit of history here with this. One of my predecessors from the state of Washington, Henry Jackson, Senator Jackson, was a very big supporter of the Land and Water Conservation Fund.
And a member of the original commission, yeah.
And a member of the original commission. And at that time, then President Kennedy and Senator Jackson and many others saw the basic growth patterns of the United States, saw that we were becoming much more with the interstate highway system and suburban development, a very rapid growth area throughout various western states, and that's where the Land and Water Conservation Fund came from. So now here we are today, and I applaud my colleagues for coming up with this proposal, because clearly we have a demand that is being outpaced, and without a process in place, it seems to me that what happens is that state and local governments are not without the resources that they've previously been with the Land and Water Conservation Fund, say throughout the 60s and the 70s, for a program that can provide relief to this. And so if you could comment on this instability of the funds that we've currently seen, and the fact that it seems to me that we actually are stealing these resources that are supposed to go to this Land and Water acquisition and using them for other purposes in the budget. Am I correct in that?
We would say the Congress's wisdom is reallocating, but yes, it's been taken away. And to answer you raise a very important point. That local governments, there's a very precise process put into place by the Land and Water Fund where governments had to plan a so-called statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan and look forward over years to doing a well-planned, well-thought-out development of recreation resources and parks. With the fluctuations, we saw a chart on the federal fluctuations earlier. Same has been true in the states, and the states have not been able to plan. And this not only hurts the park program, it hurts property owners who stand in line often and say, when are you going to buy my property? And so a smoothing out, that's one of the basic precepts, I think, in that Senator Landrieu and Senator Alexander have brought about, of smoothing out and having a permanent funding which will give certainty and save money.
Well, and allow us to do better planning. I wondered if I could ask Mrs. Marzullo, if you support, I was listening to the principles that you were talking about for your organization. Do you support the current Land and Water Conservation Fund and their activities?
I will profess to be an expert on everything that the Conservation Fund does, but I certainly support the principles of conservation and outdoor recreation and wildlife protection. My point is really a very targeted point, which is enough in terms of government land acquisition. The objectives that we've talked about here today, we fully support, but more government land is not needed, in our opinion, at least not a wholesale acquisition of land. is not needed to accomplish these objectives. The Constitution has always been, and in interpretations of the Constitution, the way it was formed, has been very clear that property rights are fundamental and essential, and regardless of what objectives we want to accomplish, we shouldn't do so by breaking the back of private property ownership.
I understand that point, but the Land and Water Conservation Fund does now partner, and land is acquired by a partnership between state and local governments and the federal government. So I would think under what you were just describing, you wouldn't support that. But maybe you could look at that and get back to the committee on whether the current program, because my sense is that you probably don't support the current program either.
Well, that may be true. I would like to have a chance to respond to that. But the point that I also made toward the end of my testimony is one that I would really urge the committee to look closely at, and I know a number of senators have bounced the idea back and forth, and that is the notion that there be no net loss of private property. I think there are many, I think we've all acknowledged that there are many states out west, Nevada, 80% government-owned. To the extent that the fund is used to acquire land elsewhere, then it seems to me a good principle would be to have land that is currently in private ownership restored to private ownership.
Thank you. And I see my time has Mr. Chairman, I wanted the witness to have their opportunity, but if I could submit a longer statement for the record and just say that I think that what our colleagues are putting before us is something that is very important. Mr. Diamond's point about how to plan over a period of time for many of our western regions that have such rapid growth is a very difficult thing. And then to have local governments go through a process, which is actually a very good process of prioritization, so really taxpayers' money are being spent in the right ways, because then you're looking at the demand across the country, prioritizing the need, coming up with the criteria, is a much better process. What's very frustrating to local governments in my state, and I would assume in other states, is to have none of those things funded and then to have one of their members of Congress stick in their favorite park or their favorite appropriation bill, and that's the only thing that gets funded. And that's a very challenging and frustrating thing. So I think there's a lot for the taxpayers in this kind of a program that is a regimen on prioritization of tax dollars. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And you might submit your statement or questions
at
your leisure.
Thank you.
And
sure.
Whoever they're directed
and again,
at, would you please answer them to each member of the committee. And Senator Alexander.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank each of the six witnesses for traveling some long distances, as Charles Jordan did, but all of you have made a special effort to be here. You've been succinct. I've read your testimonies, and it's been a great help to us as we really try to work our way through this. We're not trying to be a debating society here. We're actually trying to see if we can come up with something that will create a consensus. So we're doing something senators aren't always accused of doing, which is listening and seeing if we can find a way through this. I have two or three questions. I'll try to be brief in my questions so I can get to more of the witnesses. Mr. Clifton, I respect and understand the point about mandatory spending. Given your concern about mandatory spending, would you recommend that we repeal the 50% state royalty for onshore oil and gas drilling that this year gave $500 million to Wyoming, $318 million to New Mexico, $62 million to Colorado, and $54 to Utah without ever going through the federal budget?
Senator, Americans for Tax Reform would like to see as much go through the federal budget as possible. We just passed a Medicare prescription drug bill. The Congress decided that it was important. At the same time, the system is going broke in 2018. Social Security is going to go broke in 2042.
Give a year or two.
I'm sorry to interrupt. And at this point, we don't think that anything should be added to the mandatory side.
But the question is, would you be in favor of repealing the mandatory spending for, since you oppose a royalty for offshore oil drilling to be even-handed, would you be in favor of repealing the existing royalty for onshore oil and gas?
I haven't looked at it fully, to be honest with you. I think it's a great question. I will promise I'll look at it and get it to the committee.
I appreciate that.
My major concern is adding any new types of entitlements in the wake of the Medicare prescription drug benefit.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Marzullo, I appreciate your suggestion, and let me see if I can
hone in on a few things to understand your position. At one point in your testimony, you say, in our view, there's no legitimate justification for any government, state or federal, to acquire any more private property in this country. Is that what you mean?
I think conceptually, yes, but I acknowledge and tried to do so articulately in my testimony, and perhaps I failed to do so. We acknowledged that there are instances where government must acquire more private property, but we urge this committee to adopt an approach that is narrowly tailored with a heavy presumption, a rebuttable presumption, but nevertheless a heavy burden on government justifying a need for more acquisition of private property.
Thanks.
Personally, I think we have enough. And that's why we support the notion of a no net loss of private property. I think it's an idea with a lot of appeal.
Well, that's a very constructive suggestion. I mean, to say we don't need, I mean, obviously, if we needed new schools, we need new land, or if we need a new park, we need new land or a new port. But the overall sense I got from you is I think I understand your point, and I'm not sure I disagree with most of it, particularly in the western United States, where we own so much of the land. Senator Thomas had suggested no net gain as one way, to use a word of yours, to try to achieve some balance in what we do. Another thing we tried to do, Senator Landrieu and I did in fashioning this bill, was to say that in spending this money, it'd have to be willing seller, willing buyer. In other words, no land condemnation. Is that also something that would help achieve balance in your view?
I listened very carefully to that exchange because, frankly, with some surprise to the notion of the willing seller, and perhaps in Louisiana they do things differently. But our experience has been that the notion of a willing seller is more of a fiction than a reality. Typically, what we see is the government comes in with the heavy hand of regulation and threats of condemnation and then says, gee, we'll buy your property, and how far below the fair market value we're going to give you, and that's it, take it or leave it. So to the extent that this committee could struggle with the notion of ensuring that there be adequate protections in place guaranteeing a true fair market exchange, looking at some of the principles appraisers use, that would be something that we would endorse.
That is very, very helpful. And as you reflect on this, if you have other suggestions that you see that if legislation is making its way through that would help achieve a better balance that protects property rights, recognizing that most of what we do here is a conflict of objectives and principles, I would welcome seeing them. I may ask one last question of Mr. Diamond. With your long experience with the Land and Water Conservation Fund, what do you think, maybe this is something you've already said, but looking back all the way to 1958, 1962, what can you say to those who would say that it's inappropriate to take a steady stream of funding and make it mandatory for spending rather than an appropriated year-by-year approach? How would you sum that up in the strongest possible way?
You know, we thought about this, Senator. How can we come up here and say, with all the federal, all the public needs, this one should be a dedicated fund? And I think there's several reasons. One, we alluded to earlier, the planning process makes us being able to know that in your bill, that for 6 years, this is what happened. But more fundamentally, in our view, there was a trust made with the American people in the original Land and Water Conservation Fund, whereby some portion of the resources that are being extracted, and the public owns them, that some of those resources would go back to other resources which the public wanted. And we think this is the basic justification for a dedicated fund. It is rather different. It's not a tax source, but it's a revenue source coming from a like kind, and we believe that that's the sound basis for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Landrieu, I'm going to ask my friend, Senator Alexander, can you stay for a couple of minutes?
I can, sir.
So you can preside while Senator Landrieu...
I'll be happy to.
Because I have to be somewhere, but I would like to ask two questions and then excuse me. First, I join Senator Alexander in thanking all of you, whatever difficulty it has been for you to come here. I think it's worthwhile. The cause is worthwhile, so your presence is worthwhile. Mr. Diamond, were you the author of the report that we are talking about?
I was the editor, yes, sir. There were many, it was a commission made up of 8 members of Congress and 7 private citizens, but I was the staff editor of the report.
Now, when was that done?
It was reported to President Kennedy in 1962.
Have we made any strides since that report?
Oh, yes, sir. I think we tend to forget that the federal government did not buy land for park purposes, really. Cape Cod, maybe, in 1962 was the first time it came out, this committee well knows, out of the public domain. And I think this, the Boundary Water Fund has helped the federal government fill in much-needed handholdings, buy new areas which were needed, and help the states enormously to create this system that my friend Charles Jordan referred to.
Let me say to Ms. Marzullo, I believe you have contributed to our discussion. I have noticed that Senator Alexander and Senator Landrieu are very willing to accept ideas that will make this legislation more palatable to a broader section of senators, and some ideas that you put forth will clearly be looked at. Let me ask Mr. Tell me how you say your last name again.
You can call me what you want if we can get the right money, but it's Angel.
Angel. I didn't tell you that was any quid pro quo. I'll call you Scott if that'll relieve you.
Yes, sir.
Relieve me from the responsibility of assuring you of money.
Yes, sir.
I want to ask you if you know, okay. If you don't, will you find out? First, can you cite the levying of the Mississippi impacts from OCS, oil and gas exploration and production, as two reasons Louisiana is losing 25 square miles of wetlands each and every year?
Yes, sir. Appreciate the opportunity that you had to visit with us in the state. Certainly the levying of the Mississippi River.
But were you there when I visited?
No, sir. I was actually doing something else in local government at that time.
I think they told me that.
Yes. Thank you. The levying of the Mississippi River certainly had great intentions, and some of the unintended consequences are interrupting the deltaic system. The Mississippi River can no longer overflow its banks and replenish the coastal marshlands and wetlands of Louisiana. And there's, you know, all scientists have come to, certainly a majority of scientists have come to that conclusion. When we talk about the oil and gas situation, you know, we talk about the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway and the navigation channels that have been built and saltwater intrusion. While we are very proud of our relationship with the oil and gas industry and look forward to continuing our role to serve America's energy needs, there's no question that there's been some impact.
Now, under Section 8G of the OCS Lands Act, Louisiana has received $969 million since 1986. How much of that revenue that Louisiana receives from the federal oil and gas activities is spent on wetlands mitigation?
I'm not qualified to answer that at this time. I can get that for you and enter into the record, sir.
Would you be surprised if it was none?
I would say that it's my understanding that the majority of those funds have been used for education, and obviously in Louisiana we put that at the very top, and we are making considerable strides in our education. In fact, here recently one of the accountability acts that was passed in Louisiana is now being used as a model in America. So we are proud of that, and it has helped us in a lot of areas, but certainly coastal restoration is a very important issue for us.
So you understand the purpose of my question?
Yes, sir.
Could you also tell the committee, if you don't know, would you get it, how much of the state of Louisiana, how much do you realize in property, payroll, and corporate income from the OCS oil and gas exploration and production?
I'll get that answer for you, sir.
Okay. How much does the state of Louisiana realize in income from oil and gas exploration and production on state lands? and how much of that income is devoted to wetlands reclamation and mitigation. No, I mean submerged state land.
Right. I can't answer that question. I think here in the current year, about $450 million direct to the state budget. One of the positive things that we have done in Louisiana is we have adopted a constitutional amendment that provides and dedicates a source of those funds, a portion of those funds, to coastal wetlands activities. We're using those funds to match some of the requirements of our federal partners.
Before I leave, I want to also congratulate the two lead sponsors of this bill. Senator Alexander, I commend you. You've done a lot of work. You told me about this when you first came here, and it's extraordinary that you have moved this rapidly and understand this so well. But I wouldn't be surprised, because you have a great experience in working on these kind of things. And Senator Landrieu, I've got to know you very well. I was very privileged to be in your state. Now all I have to do is find a reason for getting you to come to my state.
All right.
Thank you very much, and thank you, witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could I just, as the chairman, I know, has been so gracious with his time and has to step out, but I'm going to be proud to submit what Louisiana has contributed to this effort over the last 20 years with virtually little help from the federal government, to remind the staff and others that we have to put up 25 to 40% of all the Corps of Engineering projects that go on our state. A lot of those projects are not just for flood protection, but for commerce and dredging. So the taxpayers of Louisiana pick up a substantial amount of money to manage and maintain this coastal area, not for the benefit of just the people that live in Louisiana. We drain two-thirds of the continental United States. And we are trying to preserve 80% of the coastal wetlands left in the United States of America. Those coastal wetlands don't just benefit the 4.5 million people that live in our state, but they benefit the 300 million people that live in the United States. So I will submit more details to the record, but I didn't want this committee to close, Senator Alexander, with there being any thought that the taxpayers of Louisiana haven't contributed mightily to this effort, basically standing alone against the tide. On top of which, we are contributing, as I said, anywhere from $2 billion to $6 billion, depending on the leasing activity, virtually alone in the nation. And it is a tragedy and a crime that we have not been compensated in a fair and more just manner than we have to date. And in addition, for the taxpayers of Louisiana to be willing to share this revenue with the rest of the country, even to those states who refuse to produce the oil and gas themselves, is also a testament to the generosity and the big-heartedness of people in Louisiana who understand. And I just have two questions, and then I'll be ready to wrap up. I want to understand, Mr. Clifton, if the people that you represent, given their choices to send the $6 billion either to the Federal Treasury for general expansion of operating revenues, or would they rather see a portion of this revenue dedicated to preserving, to be good stewards of the land we already have, and purchasing properties so that all taxpayers, whether you're wealthy or middle income or poor, could benefit? Are you testifying before this committee that the people you represent would rather see the federal budget expanded as opposed to an investment in conservation?
Senator, I think that's a great question. And let me first say, we represent about 100,000 taxpayers who are members of Americans for Tax Reform. They've joined our membership because they oppose a largening of the federal budget and federal spending. But with that said, the federal government is still providing a lot of money right now for conservation let me give you an example. The National Park Service right now is spending enormous amount of money despite the backload. But with that said, what we see is a trend happening at the nationally is local governments instituting taxes on top of their property tax rate dedicated for open space and conservation purposes. We also see state governments now branching into that. The common identity of those programs is that voters are voting themselves to, some of them get rejected, some of them get approved, but voters are having a say whether they would want higher taxes for those purposes.
Do I have an exact breakdown of how that has panned out right now? No. But the fact is that taxpayers have a choice. Here it's very much more diffused from the taxpayer, and our members are opposed to new spending on federal programs.
Well, you may want to just take back one of the goals of Senator Alexander and my bill is to keep taxes lower and to use the taxes that we already have in ways that the taxpayers tell us that they want those money spent for. And I'd like to submit to your organization the most recent study conducted by Luntz, Mr. Luntz, Frank Luntz, thank you, that indicates exactly that point, that the taxpayers of the United States would like to see a portion of the tax dollars already being paid, not new dollars directed to these programs. Ms. Marsula, just one question. Under the philosophy of, I guess, people who have money can own property and those that don't get the benefits of it, how does your organization argue the idea that people with less resources would obviously, under your philosophy, have no access to open space or lakes or streams because unless you can own it, you can't use it? How do you all square your philosophy? Because I hear you say that you think that all property should basically be privately owned. In that case, the only people that own it could use it. So what about the millions and millions and hundreds of millions of people that don't own a lake? Where do they go to swim?
Well, I could spend the rest of the afternoon answering that question because
I'm serious.
Yes.
Where do the people that don't own a lake, where do they go to swim? And I'd like to give you a minute and a half to answer that.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to just clarify that property, of course, is more than just land, but the topic, of course, is land. And the answer, I think the short answer is that I don't think that the only way that we can have outdoor recreation in this country is by government ownership of land or water. I think there have been countless studies done. I'd be happy to submit reports and analyses that talk about private ownership and ways of accomplishing many of the objectives, if not all of the objectives that we've talked about here today. But I'd also like to underscore the fact that my testimony is not that we should have no government ownership of any land for any reason ever. My testimony today is to urge the committee not to create a slush fund to acquire more. The balance has been struck. There is a balance between government ownership of land and private ownership of land, and it's a constitutional balance that's being struck. So let's not go off in the direction of extremities.
Okay, I'd agree with that. So when you refer to communism, that might be something that we would want to keep in mind. But I would like an answer to my question in writing, if you would. Where do the people that don't own a lake swim? And you can submit that to me anytime in the next couple of weeks. Thank you.
I'd be delighted to.
Thank you.
Senator Landrieu, thank you. This has been, I don't know how the senator from Louisiana feels about it, but we go to lots of hearings. This has been one of the better hearings, I think, that I've had a chance to attend because we've had a very clear purpose. We've had good attendance from a lot of senators. They provide lots of different points of view, and we've had excellent witnesses. The administration's testimony was on point and direct and very helpful. And then the six of you, I think, gave us exactly the range of thoughts and opinions that we hoped to elicit. I mean, we didn't want to just get one side, or we didn't want to hear the cheerleaders of the opponents. We wanted to hear, in this big, complicated country of ours, what should we take into account as we try to move ahead with this? And we've heard about Louisiana's interests and what's happening on the coast. Charles Jordan, as he has for years, eloquently talked about city parks. I well remember President Reagan's Commission on the Americans Outdoors. One of its most important points was that so many people live close to home. Let's create some parks close to where the people live. Mr. Waldman reminds us that the great gains we've made with our, I still call them game and fish commissions across this country. These are the organizations that our hunters and fishermen love because they create sporting and outdoors activities that all of us enjoy. Henry Diamond's brought us a perspective that spans the whole history of the Land and Water Conservation Fund, for which we're very grateful. Ms. Marzullo, I appreciate your specific suggestions that we can consider about how to achieve a better balance as we consider land acquisition. Mr. Clifton, thank you for your directness about the importance of keeping in mind our budget. Senator Landrieu and I now intend to work with our colleagues. We're going to fashion an amendment to the existing legislation that will include the federal side of the Land and Water Conservation Fund, but we've learned some things here today and from our colleagues that we need to take into account there. Then we'll decide where to go from here. She's been working on this for a number of years. I want to salute her for that during her whole first term. This was a major priority. It would never have gotten to this point if it hadn't. I had the privilege of working on outside of Congress as a governor with our state commissions and as chairman of President Reagan's Commission on Americans Outdoors. And I think it's worth saying that this idea has had strong bipartisan support. It's had presidential support. And let's see, it was as legislators, we can find a way to create a consensus within the Senate that recognizes what I believe is the huge conservation majority in the United States that supports the American Outdoors Act. My final statement will be I'd like to submit to our committee hearing a list of the 24 American Outdoors Bill supporters. These are organizations, actually it's more like 3 or 4 dozen, ranging from the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the National Wildlife Federation, to the Boone and Crockett Club and a variety of outdoor recreation organizations. They have letters in support of this activity. Senator Landrieu, if you have nothing else, thank the witnesses, and the hearing is concluded. Thank you.